This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are, by Seth Stevens Davidowitz, read by Timothy Andres Pavone. Forward. Ever since philosophers speculated about a cerebroscope, a mythical device that would display a person's thoughts on a screen, social scientists have been looking for tools to expose the workings of human nature. During my career as an experimental psychologist, different ones have gone in and out of fashion, and I've tried them all. Rating scales, reaction times, pupil dilation, functional neuroimaging, even epilepsy patients with implanted electrodes who were happy to while away the hours in a language experiment while waiting to have a seizure. Yet none of these methods provides an unobstructed view into the mind. The problem is a savage trade-off. Human thoughts are complex propositions. Unlike Woody Allen's speed-reading War and Peace, we don't just think, quote, it was about some Russians. But propositions in all their tangled multidimensional glory are difficult for a scientist to analyze. Sure, when people pour their hearts out, we apprehend the richness of their stream of consciousness, but monologues are not an ideal data set for testing hypotheses. On the other hand, if we concentrate on measures that are easily quantifiable, like people's reaction time to words or their skin response to pictures, we can do the statistics, but we pureed the complex texture of cognition into a single number. Even the most sophisticated neuroimaging methodologies can tell us how a thought is splayed out in 3D space, but not what the thought consists of. As if the trade-off between tractability and richness weren't bad enough, scientists of human nature are vexed by the law of small numbers. Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman's name for the fallacy of thinking that the traits of a population will be reflected in any sample, no matter how small. Even the most numerate scientists have woefully defective intuitions about how many subjects one really needs in a study before one can abstract away from the random quirks and bumps and generalize to all Americans, to say nothing of Homo sapiens. It's all the iffier when the sample is gathered by convenience, such as by offering beer money to the sophomores in our courses. Everybody Lies is about a whole new way of studying the mind. Big data from internet searches and other online responses are not a cerebroscope, but Seth Stevens Davidowitz shows that they offer an unprecedented peek into people's psyches. At the privacy of their keyboards, people confess the strangest things, sometimes as in dating sites or searches for professional advice, because they have real-life consequences, at other times precisely because they don't have consequences. People can unburden themselves of some wish or fear, without a real person reacting in dismay, or worse. Either way, the people are not just pressing a button or turning a knob, but keying in any number of trillions of sequences of characters to spell out their thoughts in all their explosive, combinatorial vastness. Better still, they lay down these digital traces in a form that is easy to aggregate and analyze. They come from all walks of life. They can take part in unobtrusive experiments which vary the stimuli and tabulate the responses in real time, and they happily supply these data in gargantuan numbers. Everybody Lies is more than a proof of concept. Time and again, my preconceptions about my country and my species were turned upside down by Stevens Davidowitz's discoveries. Where did Donald Trump's unexpected support come from? When Ann Landers asked her readers in 1976 whether they regretted having children and was shocked to find that a majority did, was she misled by an unrepresentative, self-selected sample? Is the internet to blame for that redundantly named crisis of the late 2010s, the filter bubble? What triggers hate crimes? Do people seek jokes to cheer themselves up? And though I like to think that nothing can shock me, I was shocked aplenty by what the internet reveals about human sexuality, including the discovery that every month a certain number of women search for humping stuffed animals. No experiment using reaction time or pupil dilation or functional neuroimaging could ever have turned up that fact. Everybody will enjoy Everybody Lies. With unflagging curiosity and an endearing wit, Stevens Davidowitz points to a new path for social science in the 21st century. With this endlessly fascinating window into human obsessions, who needs a cerebroscope? Steven Pinker, 2017. Introduction. The outlines of a revolution. Surely he would lose, they said. In the 2016 Republican primaries, polling experts concluded that Donald Trump didn't stand a chance. After all, Trump had insulted a variety of minority groups. The polls and their interpreters told us few Americans approved of such outrages. Most polling experts at the time thought that Trump would lose in the general election. Too many likely voters said they were put off by his manner and views. But there were actually some clues that Trump might actually win both the primaries and the general election on the Internet. I am an Internet data expert. Every day I track the digital trails that people leave as they make their way across the web. From the buttons or keys we click or tap, I try to understand what we really want, what we will really do, and who we really are. Let me explain how I got started on this unusual path. The story begins, and this seems like ages ago, with the 2008 presidential election and a long-debated question in social science: how significant is racial prejudice in America? Barack Obama was running as the first African-American presidential nominee of a major party. He won rather easily, and the polls suggested that race was not a factor in how Americans voted. Gallup, for example, conducted numerous polls before and after Obama's first election. Their conclusion? American voters largely did not care that Barack Obama was black. Shortly after the election, two well-known professors at the University of California, Berkeley, poured through other survey-based data using more sophisticated data mining techniques. They reached a similar conclusion. And so, during Obama's presidency, this became the conventional wisdom in many parts of the media and in large swaths of the academy. The sources that the media and social scientists have used for 80-plus years to understand the world told us that the overwhelming majority of Americans did not care that Obama was black when judging whether he should be their president. This country, long soiled by slavery and Jim Crow laws, seemed finally to have stopped judging people by the color of their skin. This seemed to suggest that racism was on its last legs in America. In fact, some pundits even declared that we lived in a post-racial society. In 2012, I was a graduate student in economics, lost in life, burnt out in my field, and confident, even cocky, that I had a pretty good understanding of how the world worked, of what people thought and cared about in the 21st century, and when it came to this issue of prejudice, I allowed myself to believe, based on everything I had read in psychology and political science, that explicit racism was limited to a small percentage of Americans, the majority of them conservative Republicans, most of them living in the Deep South. Then I found Google Trends. Google Trends, a tool that was released with little fanfare in 2009, tells users how frequently any word or phrase has been searched in different locations at different times. It was advertised as a fun tool, perhaps enabling friends to discuss which celebrity was most popular or what fashion was suddenly hot. The earliest versions included a playful admonishment that people wouldn't want to write your PhD dissertation with the data, which immediately motivated me to write my dissertation with it. At the time, Google search data didn't seem to be a proper source of information for quote-unquote serious academic research. Unlike surveys, Google search data wasn't created as a way to help us understand the human psyche. Google was invented so that people could learn about the world, not so researchers could learn about people. But it turns out the trails we leave as we seek knowledge on the Internet are tremendously revealing. In other words, people's search for information is in itself information. When and where they search for facts, quotes, jokes, places, persons, things, or help, it turns out, can tell us a lot more about what they really think, really desire, really fear, and really do than anyone might have guessed. This is especially true since people sometimes don't so much query Google as confide in it. I hate my boss. I am drunk. My dad hit me. The everyday act of typing a word or phrase into a compact, rectangular white box leaves a small trace of truth, that when multiplied by millions eventually reveals profound realities. The first word I typed in Google Trends was God. I learned that the states that make the most Google searches mentioning God were Alabama, Mississippi, and Arkansas, the Bible Belt, and those searches are most frequently on Sundays. None of which was surprising, but it was intriguing that search data could reveal such a clear pattern. I tried Nix, which it turns out is Googled most in New York City. Another no-brainer. Then I typed in my name. We're sorry, Google Trends informed me. There is not enough search volume to show these results. Google Trends, I learned, will only provide data when lots of people make the same search. But the power of Google searches is not that they can tell us that God is popular down south, the Knicks are popular in New York City, or that I'm not popular anywhere. Any survey could tell you that. The power in Google data is that people tell the giant search engine things they might not tell anyone else. Take, for example, sex, a subject I will investigate in much greater detail later in this audiobook. Surveys cannot be trusted to tell us the truth about our sex lives. I analyzed data from the General Social Survey, which is considered one of the most influential and authoritative sources for information on Americans' behaviors. According to that survey, when it comes to heterosexual sex, women say they have sex on average 55 times per year, using a condom 16% of the time. This adds up to about 1.1 billion condoms used per year. But heterosexual men say they use 1.6 billion condoms every year. Those numbers, by definition, would have to be the same. So who is telling the truth? Men or women? Neither, it turns out. According to Nielsen, the global information and measurement company that tracks consumer behavior, fewer than 600 million condoms are sold every year. So everyone is lying. The only difference is by how much. The lying is in fact widespread. Men who have never been married claim to use on average 29 condoms per year. This would add up to more than the total number of condoms sold in the United States to married and single people combined. Married people probably exaggerate how much sex they have too. On average, married men under 65 tell surveys they have sex once a week. Only 1% say they have gone the past year without sex. Married women report having a little less sex, but not much less. Google searches give a far less lively, and I argue far more accurate, picture of sex during marriage. On Google, the top complaint about a marriage is not having sex. Searches for sexless marriage are 3.5 times more common than unhappy marriage, and 8 times more common than loveless marriage. Even unmarried couples complain somewhat frequently about not having sex. Google searches for sexless relationship are second only to searches for abusive relationship. This data, I should emphasize, is all presented anonymously. Google, of course, does not report data about any particular individual searches. And Google searches presented a picture of America that was strikingly different from that post-racial utopia sketched out by the surveys. I remember when I first typed nigger into Google Trends. Call me naive, but given how toxic the word is, I fully expected this to be a low-volume search. Boy, was I wrong. In the United States, the word nigger, or its plural, niggers, was included in roughly the same number of searches as the word migraines, economist, and Lakers. I wondered if searches for rap lyrics were skewing the results. Nope. The word used in rap songs is almost always niggas. So what was the motivation of Americans searching for nigger? Frequently, they were looking for jokes mocking African Americans. In fact, 20% of searches with the word nigger also included the word jokes. Other common searches included stupid niggers and I hate niggers. There were millions of these searches every year. A large number of Americans were in the privacy of their own homes, making shockingly racist inquiries. The more I researched, the more disturbing the information got. On Obama's first election night, when most of the commentary focused on praise of Obama and acknowledgement of the historic nature of his election, roughly 1 in every 100 Google searches that included the word Obama also included KKK or niggers. Maybe that doesn't sound so high, but think of the thousands of non-racist reasons to Google this young outsider with a charming family about to take over the world's most powerful job. On election night, searches and signups for Stormfront a white nationalist site with surprisingly high popularity in the United States, were more than 10 times higher than normal. In some states, there were more searches for "nigger president" than "first black president." There was a darkness and hatred that was hidden from the traditional sources, but was quite apparent in the searches that people made. Those searches are hard to reconcile with a society in which racism is a small factor. In 2012, I knew of Donald J. Trump mostly as a businessman and reality show performer. I had no more idea than anyone else that he would 4 years later be a serious presidential candidate. But those ugly searches are not hard to reconcile with the success of a candidate who, in his attacks on immigrants, in his angers and resentments, often played to people's worst inclinations. The Google searches also told us that much of what we thought about the location of racism was wrong. Surveys and conventional wisdom placed modern racism predominantly in the South and mostly among Republicans. But the places with the highest racist search rates included upstate New York, western Pennsylvania, eastern Ohio, industrial Michigan and rural Illinois, along with West Virginia, southern Louisiana, and Mississippi. The true divide, Google search data suggested, was not South versus North. It was East versus West. You don't get this sort of thing much west of the Mississippi. And racism was not limited to Republicans. In fact, racist searches were no higher in places with a high percentage of Republicans than in places with a high percentage of Democrats. Google searches, in other words, helped draw a new map of racism in the United States. And this map looked very different from what you may have guessed. Republicans in the South may be more likely to admit to racism, but plenty of Democrats in the North have similar attitudes. 4 years later, this map would prove quite significant in explaining the political success of Trump. In 2012, I was using this map of racism I had developed using Google searches to reevaluate exactly the role that Obama's race played. The data was clear. In parts of the country with a high number of racist searches, Obama did substantially worse than John Kerry, the white Democratic presidential candidate, had 4 years earlier. The relationship was not explained by any other factor about these areas, including education levels, age, church attendance, or gun ownership. Racist searches did not predict poor performance for any other Democratic candidate, only for Obama. And the results implied a large effect. Obama lost roughly 4 percentage points nationwide just from explicit racism. This was far higher than might have been expected based on any surveys. Barack Obama, of course, was elected and re-elected president, helped by some very favorable conditions for Democrats, but he had to overcome quite a bit more than anyone who was relying on traditional data sources, and that was just about everyone, had realized. There were enough racists to help win a primary or tip a general election in a year not so favorable to Democrats. My study was initially rejected by 5 academic journals. Many of the peer reviewers, if you will forgive a little disgruntlement, said that it was impossible to believe that so many Americans harbored such vicious racism. This simply did not fit what people had been saying. Besides, Google searches seemed like such a bizarre data set. Now that we have witnessed the inauguration of President Donald J. Trump, my finding seems more plausible. The more I have studied, the more I have learned that Google has lots of information that is missed by the polls that can be helpful in understanding, among many, many other subjects, an election. There is information on who will actually turn out to vote. More than half of citizens who don't vote tell surveys immediately before an election that they intend to, skewing our estimation of turnout. Whereas Google searches for how to vote or where to vote weeks before an election can accurately predict which parts of the country are going to have a big showing at the polls. There might even be information on who they will vote for. Can we really predict which candidate people will vote for just based on what they search? Clearly, we can't just study which candidates are searched for most frequently. Many people search for a candidate because they love him. A similar number of people search for a candidate because they hate him. That said, Stuart Gabriel, a professor of finance at the University of California, Los Angeles, and I have found a surprising clue about which way people are planning to vote. A large percentage of election-related searches contain queries with both candidates' names. During the 2016 election between Trump and Hillary Clinton, some people searched for Trump-Clinton polls. Others looked for highlights from the Clinton-Trump debate. In fact, 12% of search queries with Trump also included the word Clinton. More than one quarter of search queries with Clinton also included the word Trump. We have found that these seemingly neutral searches may actually give us some clues to which candidate a person supports. How? The order in which the candidates appear. Our research suggests that a person is significantly more likely to put the candidate they support first in a search that includes both candidates' names. In the previous three elections, the candidate who appeared first in more searches received the most votes. More interesting, the order the candidates were searched was predictive of which way a particular state would go. The order in which candidates are searched also seems to contain information that the polls can miss. In the 2012 election between Obama and Republican Mitt Romney, Nate Silver, the virtuoso statistician and journalist, accurately predicted the result in all 50 states. However, we found that in states that listed Romney before Obama in searches most frequently, Romney actually did better than Silver had predicted. In states that most frequently listed Obama before Romney, Obama did better than Silver predicted. This indicator could contain information that polls miss because voters are either lying to themselves or uncomfortable revealing their true preferences to pollsters. Perhaps if they claimed that they were undecided in 2012, but were consistently searching for Romney-Obama polls, Romney-Obama debate, and Romney-Obama election, they were planning to vote for Romney all along. So did Google predict Trump? Well, we still have a lot of work to do, and I'll have to be joined by lots more researchers before we know how best to use Google data to predict election results. This is a new science, and we only have a few elections for which this data exists. I'm certainly not saying we're at the point, or ever will be at the point, where we can throw out public opinion polls completely as a tool for helping us predict elections. But there were definitely portents at many points on the internet that Trump might do better than the polls were predicting. During the general election, there were clues that the electorate might be a favorable one for Trump. Black Americans told polls they would turn out in large numbers to oppose Trump, but Google searches for information on voting in heavily black areas were way down. On election day, Clinton would be hurt by low black turnout. There were even signs that supposedly undecided voters were going Trump's way. Gabriel and I found that there were more searches for Trump-Clinton than Clinton-Trump in key states in the Midwest that Clinton was expected to win. Indeed, Trump owed his election to the fact that he sharply outperformed his polls there. But the major clue, I would argue, that Trump might prove a successful candidate, in the primaries to begin with, was all that secret racism that my Obama study had uncovered. The Google searches revealed a darkness and hatred among a meaningful number of Americans that pundits for many years missed. Search data revealed that we lived in a very different society from the one academics and journalists, relying on polls, thought that we lived in. It revealed a nasty, scary, and widespread rage that was waiting for a candidate to give voice to it. People frequently lie, to themselves and to others. In 2008, Americans told surveys that they no longer cared about race. 8 years later, they elected as president Donald J. Trump, a man who retweeted a false claim that black people are responsible for the majority of murders of white Americans, defended his supporters for roughing up a Black Lives Matters protester at one of his rallies, and hesitated in repudiating support from a former leader of the Ku Klux Klan. The same hidden racism that hurt Barack Obama helped Donald Trump. Early in the primaries, Nate Silver famously claimed that there was virtually no chance that Trump would win. As the primaries progressed and it became increasingly clear that Trump had widespread support, Silver decided to look at the data to see if he could understand what was going on. How could Trump possibly be doing so well? Silver noticed that the areas where Trump performed best made for an odd map. You can see two visual reproductions on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. Trump performed well in the parts of the Northeast and industrial Midwest, as well as the South. He performed notably worse out West. Silver looked for variables to try to explain this map. Was it unemployment? Was it religion? Was it gun ownership? Was it rates of immigration? Was it opposition to Obama? Silver found that the single factor that best correlated with Donald Trump's support in the Republican primaries was that measure I had discovered 4 years earlier. Areas that supported Trump in the largest numbers were those that made the most Google searches for nigger. I have spent just about every day of the past 4 years analyzing Google data. This included a stint as a data scientist at Google, which hired me after learning about my racism research, and I continue to explore this data as an opinion writer and data journalist for the New York Times. The revelations have kept coming. Mental illness, human sexuality, child abuse, abortion, advertising, religion, health. Not exactly small topics, and this data set, which didn't exist a couple of decades ago, offered surprising new perspectives on all of them. Economists and other social scientists are always hunting for new sources of data. So let me be blunt. I am now convinced that Google searches are the most important data set ever collected on the human psyche. This data set, however, is not the only tool the internet has delivered for understanding our world. I soon realized there are other digital gold mines as well. I downloaded all of Wikipedia, pored through Facebook profiles, and scraped Stormfront. In addition, Pornhub, one of the largest pornographic sites on the internet, gave me its complete data on the searches and video views of anonymous people around the world. In other words, I have taken a very deep dive into what is now called big data. Further, I have interviewed dozens of others, academics, data journalists, and entrepreneurs, who are also exploring these new realms. Many of their studies will be discussed here. But first, a confession. I am not going to give a precise definition of what big data is. Why? Because it's an inherently vague concept. How big is big? Are 18,462 observations small data and 18,463 observations big data? I prefer to take an inclusive view of what qualifies. While most of the data I fiddle with is from the internet, I will discuss other sources too. We're living through an explosion in the amount and quality of all kinds of available information. Much of the new information flows from Google and social media. Some of it is a product of digitization of information that was previously hidden away in cabinets and files. Some of it is from increased resources devoted to market research. Some of the studies discussed in this audiobook don't use huge data sets at all, but instead just employ a new and creative approach to data, approaches that are crucial in an era overflowing with information. So why exactly is big data so powerful? Think of all the information that is scattered online on a given day. We have a number, in fact, for just how much information there is. On an average day in the early part of the 21st century, human beings generate 2.5 million trillion bytes of data. And these bytes are clues. A woman is bored on a Thursday afternoon. She Googles for some more funny, clean jokes. She checks her email. She signs on to Twitter. She Googles nigger jokes. A man is feeling blue. He Googles for depression symptoms and depression stories. He plays a game of solitaire. A woman sees the announcement of her friend getting engaged on Facebook. The woman, who is single, blocks the friend. A man takes a break from Googling about the NFL and rap music to ask the search engine a question, "Is it normal to have dreams about kissing men?" A woman clicks on a BuzzFeed story showing the 15 cutest cats. A man sees the same story about cats, but on his screen it is called 15 Most Adorable Cats. He doesn't click. A woman Googles, "Is my son a genius?" A man Googles, "How to get my daughter to lose weight?" A woman is on a vacation with her 6 best female friends. All her friends keep saying how much fun they're having. She sneaks off to Google, "Loneliness when away from husband." A man, the previous woman's husband, is on a vacation with his 6 best male friends. He sneaks off to Google to type, "Signs your wife is cheating." Some of this data will include information that would otherwise never be admitted to anybody. If we aggregate it all, keep it anonymous to make sure we never know about the fears, desires, and behaviors of any specific individuals, and add some data science, we start to get a new look at human beings, their behaviors, their desires, their natures. In fact, at the risk of sounding grandiose, I have come to believe that the new data increasingly available in our digital age will radically expand our understanding of humankind. The microscope showed us there is more to a drop of pond water than we think we see. The telescope showed us there is more to the night sky than we think we see. And new, digital data now shows us there is more to human society than we think we see. It may be our era's microscope or telescope, making possible important, even revolutionary insights. There is another risk in making such declarations, not just sounding grandiose, but also trendy. Many people have been making big claims about the power of big data, but they have been short on evidence. This has inspired big data skeptics, of whom there are also many, to dismiss the search for bigger data sets. I am not saying here that there is no information in big data, essayist and statistician Nassim Taleb has written. There is plenty of information. The problem, the central issue, is that the needle comes in an increasingly larger haystack. One of the primary goals of this audiobook, then, is to provide the missing evidence of what can be done with big data, how we can find the needles, if you will, in those larger and larger haystacks. I hope to provide enough examples of big data offering new insights into human psychology and behavior so that you'll begin to see the outlines of something truly revolutionary. Hold on, Seth, you might be saying right about now. You're promising a revolution. You're waxing poetic about these big new data sets. But thus far, you have used all of this amazing, remarkable, breathtaking, groundbreaking data to tell me basically two things. There are plenty of racists in America, and people, particularly men, exaggerate how much sex they have. I admit sometimes the new data does just confirm the obvious. If you think these findings were obvious, wait until you get to Chapter 4, where I show you clear, unimpeachable evidence from Google searches that men have tremendous concern and insecurity around, wait for it, their penis size. There is, I would claim, some value in proving things you may have already suspected, but had otherwise little evidence for. Suspecting something is one thing, proving it is another. But if all big data could do is confirm your suspicions, it wouldn't be revolutionary. Thankfully, big data can do a lot more than that. Time and again, data shows me the world works in precisely the opposite way as I would have guessed. Here are some examples you might find more surprising. You might think that a major cause of racism is economic insecurity and vulnerability. You might naturally suspect, then, that when people lose their jobs, racism increases. But actually, neither racist searches nor membership in Stormfront rises when unemployment does. You might think that anxiety is highest in over-educated big cities. The urban neurotic is a famous stereotype. But Google searches reflecting anxiety, such as anxiety symptoms or anxiety help, tend to be higher in places with lower levels of education, lower median incomes, and where a larger portion of the population lives in rural areas. There are higher search rates for anxiety in rural upstate New York than New York City. You might think that a terrorist attack that kills dozens or hundreds of people would automatically be followed by massive, widespread anxiety. Terrorism, by definition, is supposed to instill a sense of terror. I looked at Google searches reflecting anxiety. I tested how much these searches rose in a country in the days, weeks, and months following every major European or American terrorist attack since 2004. So on average, how much did anxiety-related searches rise? They didn't. At all. You might think that people search for jokes more often when they are sad. Many of history's greatest thinkers have claimed that we turn to humor as a release from pain. Humor has long been thought of as a way to cope with the frustrations, the pain, the inevitable disappointments of life. As Charlie Chaplin put it, laughter is the tonic, the relief, the surcease from pain. However, searches for jokes are lowest on Mondays, the day when people report they are most unhappy. They are lowest on cloudy and rainy days, and they plummet after a major tragedy, such as when two bombs killed three and injured hundreds during the 2013 Boston Marathon. People are actually more likely to seek out jokes when things are going well in life than when they aren't. Sometimes a new data set reveals a behavior, desire, or concern that I would have never even considered. There are numerous sexual proclivities that fall into this category, For example, did you know that in India, the number one search beginning, "My husband wants," is "My husband wants me to breastfeed him?" This comment is far more common in India than in other countries. Moreover, porn searches for depictions of women breastfeeding men are 4 times higher in India and Bangladesh than in any other country in the world. I certainly never would have suspected that before I saw the data. Further, while the fact that men are obsessed with their penis size may not be too surprising, the biggest bodily insecurity for women, as expressed on Google, is surprising indeed. Based on this new data, the female equivalent of worrying about the size of your penis may be, pausing to build suspense, worrying about whether your vagina smells. Women make nearly as many searches expressing concern about their genitals as men do worrying about theirs. And the top concern women express is its odor and how they might improve it. I certainly didn't know that before I saw the data. Sometimes new data reveals cultural differences I had never even contemplated. One example, the very different ways that men around the world respond to their wives being pregnant. In Mexico, the top searches about "my pregnant wife" include frases de amor para mi esposa embarazada, words of love to my pregnant wife, and poemas para mi esposa embarazada, poems for my pregnant wife. In the United States, the top searches include "my wife is pregnant, now what?" and "my wife is pregnant, what do I do?" But this book is more than a collection of odd facts or one-off studies, though there will be plenty of those. Because these methodologies are so new and are only going to get more powerful, I will lay out some ideas on how they work and what makes them groundbreaking. I will also acknowledge big data's limitations. Some of the enthusiasm for the data revolution's potential has been misplaced. Most of those enamored with big data gush about how immense these datasets can get. This obsession with dataset size is not new. Before Google, Amazon, and Facebook, before the phrase big data existed, a conference was held in Dallas, Texas on large and complex datasets. Jerry Friedman, a statistics professor at Stanford who was a colleague of mine when I worked at Google, recalls that 1977 conference. One distinguished statistician would get up to talk. He would explain that he had accumulated an amazing, astonishing 5 gigabytes of data. The next distinguished statistician would get up to talk. He would begin, "The last speaker had gigabytes. That's nothing. I've got terabytes." The emphasis of the talk, in other words, was on how much information you could accumulate, not what you hope to do with it or what questions you plan to answer. "I found it amusing at the time," Friedman says, "that the thing that you were supposed to be impressed with was how large their data set is." It still happens. Too many data scientists today are accumulating massive sets of data and telling us very little of importance, e.g., that the Knicks are popular in New York. Too many businesses are drowning in data. They have lots of terabytes, but few major insights. The size of a data set, I believe, is frequently overrated. There is a subtle but important explanation for this. The bigger in effect, the fewer the number of observations necessary to see it. You only need to touch a hot stove once to realize that it's dangerous. You may need to drink coffee thousands of times to determine whether it tends to give you a headache. Which lesson is more important? Clearly the hot stove, which, because of the intensity of its impact, shows up so quickly with so little data. In fact, the smartest big data companies are often cutting down their data. At Google, major decisions are based on only a tiny sampling of all their data. You don't always need a ton of data to find important insights. You need the right data. A major reason that Google searches are so valuable is not that there are so many of them. It is that people are so honest in them. People lie to friends, lovers, doctors, surveys, and themselves. But on Google, they might share embarrassing information about, among other things, their sexless marriages, their mental health issues, their insecurities, and their animosity toward black people. Most important, to squeeze insights out of big data, you have to ask the right questions. Just as you can't point a telescope randomly at the night sky and have it discover Pluto for you, you can't download a whole bunch of data and have it discover the secrets of human nature for you. You must look in promising places. Google searches that begin, "My husband wants," in India, for example. This audiobook is going to show how big data is best used and explain in detail why it can be so powerful. And along the way, you'll also learn about what I and others have already discovered with it, including how many men are gay, does advertising work, why was American Pharoah a great racehorse, is the media biased, are Freudian slips real, who cheats on their taxes, does it matter where you go to college, can you beat the stock market, what's the best place to raise kids, what makes a story go viral, what should you talk about on a first date if you want a second, and much, much more. But before we get to all that, we need to discuss a more basic question. Why do we need data at all? And for that, I am going to introduce my grandmother. Part 1. Data, big and small. 1. Your faulty gut. If you're 33 years old and have attended a few Thanksgivings in a row without a date, the topic of mate choice is likely to arise, and just about everybody will have an opinion. Seth needs a crazy girl like him, my sister says. You're crazy. He needs a normal girl to balance him out, my brother says. Seth's not crazy, my mother says. You're crazy. Of course Seth is crazy, my father says. All of a sudden, my shy, soft-spoken grandmother, quiet through the dinner, speaks. The loud, aggressive New York voices go silent, and all eyes focus on the small old lady with short yellow hair and still a trace of an Eastern European accent. Seth, you need a nice girl. Not too pretty, very smart, good with people, social, so you will do things, sense of humor, because you have a good sense of humor. Why does this old woman's advice command such attention and respect in my family? Well, my 88-year-old grandmother has seen more than everybody else at the table. She's observed more marriages, many that worked and many that didn't, and over the decades, she has cataloged the qualities that make for successful relationships. At that Thanksgiving table, for that question, my grandmother has access to the largest number of data points. My grandmother is big data. In this audiobook, I want to demystify data science. Like it or not, data is playing an increasingly important role in all of our lives, and its role is going to get larger. Newspapers now have full sections devoted to data. Companies have teams with the exclusive task of analyzing their data. Investors give startups tens of millions of dollars if they can store more data. Even if you never learn how to run a regression or calculate a confidence interval, you are going to encounter a lot of data in the pages you read, the business meetings you attend, the gossip you hear next to the water coolers you drink from. Many people are anxious over this development. They are intimidated by data, easily lost and confused in a world of numbers. They think that a quantitative understanding of the world is for a select few left-brain prodigies, not for them. As soon as they encounter numbers, they are ready to turn the page, end the meeting, or change the conversation. But I have spent 10 years in the data analysis business and have been fortunate to work with many of the top people in the field, and one of the most important lessons I have learned is this. Good data science is less complicated than people think. The best data science, in fact, is surprisingly intuitive. What makes data science intuitive? At its core, data science is about spotting patterns and predicting how one variable will affect another. People do this all the time. Just think how my grandmother gave me relationship advice. She utilized the large database of relationships that her brain has uploaded over a near century of life in the stories she has heard from her family, her friends, her acquaintances. She limited her analysis to a sample of relationships in which the man had many qualities that I have, a sensitive temperament, a tendency to isolate himself, a sense of humor. She zeroed in on key qualities of the woman, how kind she was, how smart she was, how pretty she was. She correlated these key qualities of the woman with a key quality of the relationship, whether it was a good one. Finally, she reported her results. In other words, she spotted patterns and predicted how one variable will affect another. Grandma is a data scientist. You're a data scientist too. When you were a kid, you noticed that when you cried, your mom gave you attention. That's data science. When you reached adulthood, You notice that if you complain too much, people want to hang out with you less. That's data science, too. When people hang out with you less, you noticed you're less happy. When you're less happy, you're less friendly. When you're less friendly, people want to hang out with you even less. Data science, data science, data science. Because data science is so natural, the best big data studies I have found can be understood by just about any smart person. If you can't understand a study, the problem is probably with the study, not with you. Want proof that great data science tends to be intuitive? I recently came across a study that may be one of the most important conducted in the past few years. It is also one of the most intuitive studies I've ever seen. I want you to think not just about the importance of the study, but how natural and grandma-like it is. The study was by a team of researchers from Columbia University and Microsoft. The team wanted to find what symptoms predict pancreatic cancer. This disease has a low 5-year survival rate, only about 3%, but early detection can double a patient's chances. The researchers' method? They utilized data from tens of thousands of anonymous users of Bing, Microsoft's search engine. They coded a user as having recently been given a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer based on unmistakable searches such as "just diagnosed with pancreatic cancer" or "I was told I have pancreatic cancer, what to expect?" Next, the researchers looked at searches for health symptoms. They compared that small number of users who later reported a pancreatic cancer diagnosis with those who didn't. What symptoms, in other words, predicted that in a few weeks or months, a user will be reporting a diagnosis? The results were striking. Searching for back pain and then yellowing skin turned out to be a sign of pancreatic cancer. Searching for just back pain alone made it unlikely someone had pancreatic cancer. Similarly, searching for indigestion and then abdominal pain was evidence of pancreatic cancer, while searching for just indigestion without abdominal pain meant a person was unlikely to have it. The researchers could identify 5 to 15% of cases with almost no false positives. Now, this may not sound like a great rate, but if you have pancreatic cancer, even a 10% chance of possibly doubling your chances of survival would feel like a windfall. The paper detailing this study would be difficult for non-experts to fully make sense of. It includes a lot of technical jargon such as the Kolmogorov-Smirnov test, the meaning of which I have to admit I had forgotten. It's a way to determine whether a model correctly fits data. However, note how natural and intuitive this remarkable study is at its most fundamental level. The researchers looked at a wide array of medical cases and tried to connect symptoms to a particular illness. You know who else uses this methodology in trying to figure out whether someone has a disease? Husbands and wives, mothers and fathers, and nurses and doctors. Based on experience and knowledge, they try to connect fevers, headaches, runny noses, and stomach pains to various diseases. In other words, the Columbia and Microsoft researchers wrote a groundbreaking study by utilizing the natural, obvious methodology that everybody uses to make health diagnoses. But wait, let's slow down here. If the methodology of the best data science is frequently natural and intuitive, as I claim, this raises a fundamental question about the value of big data. If humans are naturally data scientists, if data science is intuitive, why do we need computers and statistical software? Why do we need the Kolmogorov-Smirnov test? Can't we just use our gut? Can't we do it like grandma does, like nurses and doctors do? This gets to an argument intensified after the release of Malcolm Gladwell's best-selling book, Blink, which extols the magic of people's gut instincts. Gladwell tells the stories of people who, relying solely on their guts, can tell whether a statue is fake, whether a tennis player will fault before he hits the ball, how much a customer is willing to pay. The heroes in Blink do not run regressions. They do not calculate confidence intervals. They do not run Kolmogorov-Smirnov tests. But they generally make remarkable predictions. Many people have intuitively supported Gladwell's defense of intuition. They trust their guts and feelings. Fans of Blink might celebrate the wisdom of my grandmother giving relationship advice without the aid of computers. The fans of Blink may be less apt to celebrate my studies or the other studies profiled in this book which use computers. If big data of the computer type rather than the grandma type is a revolution, it has to prove that it's more powerful than our unaided intuition, which, as Gladwell has pointed out, can often be remarkable. The Columbia and Microsoft study offers a clear example of rigorous data science and computers teaching us things our gut alone could never find. This is also one case where the size of the data set matters. Sometimes there is insufficient experience for our unaided gut to draw upon. It is unlikely that you or your close friends or family members have seen enough cases of pancreatic cancer to tease out the difference between indigestion followed by abdominal pain compared to indigestion alone. Indeed, it is inevitable, as the Bing dataset gets bigger, that the researchers will pick up many more subtle patterns in the timing of symptoms for this and other illnesses that even doctors might miss. Moreover, while our gut may usually give us a good general sense of how the world works, it's frequently not precise. We need data to sharpen the picture. Consider, for example, the effects of weather on mood. You would probably guess that people are more likely to feel more gloomy on a 10-degree day than on a 70-degree day. Indeed, this is correct. But you might not guess how big an impact this temperature difference can make. I looked for correlations between an area's Google searches for depression and a wide range of factors, including economic conditions, education levels, and church attendance. Winter climate swamped all the rest. In winter months, warm climates such as that of Honolulu, Hawaii, have 40% fewer depression searches than cold climates such as that of Chicago, Illinois. Just how significant is this effect? An optimistic read of the effectiveness of antidepressants would find that the most effective drugs decrease the incidence of depression by only about 20%. To judge from the Google numbers, a Chicago to Honolulu move would be at least twice as effective as medication for your winter blues. Sometimes our gut, when not guided by careful computer analysis, can be dead wrong. We can get blinded by our own experiences and prejudices. Indeed, even though my grandmother is able to utilize her decades of experience to give better relationship advice than the rest of my family, she still has some dubious views on what makes a relationship last. For example, she has frequently emphasized to me the importance of having common friends. She believes that this was a key factor in her marriage's success. She spent most warm evenings with her husband, my grandfather, in their small backyard in Queens, New York, sitting on lawn chairs and gossiping with their tight group of neighbors. However, at the risk of throwing my own grandmother under the bus, data science suggests that Grandma's theory is wrong. A team of computer scientists recently analyzed the biggest data set ever assembled on human relationships, Facebook. They looked at a large number of couples who were at some point in a relationship. Some of these couples stayed in a relationship, others switched their status to single. Having a common core group of friends, the researchers found, is a strong predictor that a relationship will not last. Perhaps hanging out every night with your partner and the same small group of people isn't such a good thing. Separate social circles may help make relationships stronger. As you can see, our intuition alone, when we stay away from the computers and go with our gut, can sometimes amaze, but it can make big mistakes. Grandma may have fallen into one cognitive trap. We tend to exaggerate the relevance of our own experience. In the parlance of data scientists, we weight our data, and we give far too much weight to one particular data point, ourselves. Grandma was so focused on her evening schmoozes with Grandpa and their friends that she didn't think enough about other couples. She forgot to fully consider her brother-in-law and his wife, who chit-chatted most nights with a small, consistent group of friends, but fought frequently and divorced. She forgot to fully consider my parents, her daughter and son-in-law. My parents go their separate ways many nights, my dad to a jazz club or ball game with his friends, my mom to a restaurant or the theater with her friends, yet they remain happily married. When relying on our gut, we can also be thrown off by the basic human fascination with the dramatic. We tend to overestimate the prevalence of anything that makes for a memorable story. For example, when asked in a survey, people consistently rank tornadoes as a more common cause of death than asthma. In fact, asthma causes about 70 times more deaths. Deaths by asthma don't stand out and don't make the news. Deaths by tornadoes do. We are often wrong, in other words, about how the world works when we rely just on what we hear or personally experience. While the methodology of good data science is often intuitive, the results are frequently counterintuitive. Data science takes a natural and intuitive human process, spotting patterns and making sense of them, and injects it with steroids, potentially showing us that the world works in a completely different way from how we thought it did. That's what happened when I studied the predictors of basketball success. When I was a little boy, I had one dream and one dream only. I wanted to grow up to be an economist and data scientist. Nah, I'm just kidding. I wanted desperately to be a professional basketball player, to follow in the footsteps of my hero Patrick Ewing, all-star center for the New York Knicks. I sometimes suspect that inside every data scientist is a kid trying to figure out why his childhood dreams didn't come true. So it's not surprising that I recently investigated what it takes to make the NBA. The results of the investigation were surprising. In fact, they demonstrate once again how good data science can change your view of the world, and how counterintuitive the numbers can be. The particular question I looked at is this: are you more likely to make it in the NBA if you grow up poor or middle class? Most people would guess the former. Conventional wisdom says that growing up in difficult circumstances, perhaps in the projects with a single teenage mom, helps foster the drive necessary to reach the top levels of this intensely competitive sport. This view was expressed by William Ellerbe, a high school basketball coach in Philadelphia, in an interview with Sports Illustrated. "Suburban kids tend to play for the fun of it," Ellerbe said. "Inner-city kids look at basketball as a matter of life or death." I, alas, was raised by married parents in the New Jersey suburbs. LeBron James, the best player of my generation, was born poor to a 16-year-old single mother in Akron, Ohio. Indeed, an internet survey I conducted suggested that the majority of Americans think the same thing Coach Ellerbe and I thought, that most NBA players grow up in poverty. Is this conventional wisdom correct? Let's look at the data. There is no comprehensive data source on the socioeconomics of NBA players. But by being data detectives, by utilizing data from a whole bunch of sources, basketballreference.com, ancestry.com, the U.S. Census and others, we can figure out what family background is actually most conducive to making the NBA. This study, you will note, uses a variety of data sources, some of them bigger, some of them smaller, some of them online, and some of them offline. As exciting as some of the new digital sources are, a good data scientist is not above consulting old-fashioned sources if they can help. The best way to get the right answer to a question is to combine all available data. The first relevant data is the birthplace of every player. For every county in the United States, I recorded how many black and white men were born in the 1980s. I then recorded how many of them reached the NBA. I compared this to a county's average household income. I also controlled for the racial demographics of a county, since, and this is a subject for a whole other audiobook, black men are about 40 times more likely than white men to reach the NBA. The data tells us that a man has a substantially better chance of reaching the NBA if he was born in a wealthy county. A black kid born in one of the wealthiest counties in the United States, for example, is more than twice as likely to make the NBA than a black kid born in one of the poorest counties. For a white kid, the advantage of being born in one of the wealthiest counties compared to being born in one of the poorest is 60%. This suggests, contrary to conventional wisdom, that poor men are actually underrepresented in the NBA. However, this data is not perfect, since many wealthy counties in the United States, such as New York County, Manhattan, also include poor neighborhoods such as Harlem. So it's still possible that a difficult childhood helps you make the NBA. We still need more clues, more data. So I investigated the family backgrounds of NBA players. This information was found in news stories and on social networks. This methodology was quite time-consuming, so I limited the analysis to the 100 African-American NBA players born in the 1980s who scored the most points. Compared to the average black man in the United States, NBA superstars were about 30% less likely to have been born to a teenage mother or an unwed mother. In other words, the family backgrounds of the best black NBA players also suggest that a comfortable background is a big advantage for achieving success. That said, neither the county-level birth data nor the family background of a limited sample of players gives perfect information on the childhoods of all NBA players. So I was still not entirely convinced that two-parent, middle-class families produce more